Greetings, listeners, and welcome to The Story Never Ends. I'm Audrey.
And I'm Tinashe.
And this is part two of our deep dive into The Half-Blood Prince, which is the sixth book in the Harry Potter series. In part one, we discussed Half-Blood Prince up to chapter six, covering the key events such as the Muggle Prime Minister being briefed by Fudge and Scrimgeour. I think Dumbledore recruiting Slughorn with the help of Harry Potter, and Harry Potter staying at the Barrow for a bit, and then the trio also seeing Draco in Nocturne Alley, particularly in Borgin and Birks, and the things that he was getting up to there. So in this episode, we continue on from chapter seven. So let us get back into it, Tinashe. I guess, hand over to you to start us off with your thoughts from chapter seven onwards.
Wow, you're changing the tune. Did you not say we were going to start?
Oh, sorry. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. Okay. I actually forgot that, because you know how we did the little thing before? I was like, I don't know what I'm saying next. So I just went, but it's okay. I'm more than happy to start, if only from the perspective.
I don't mind starting. It's okay. I was going to say, I found it funny the fact that, although Harry is functioning on the fact that he doesn't like Draco, he hates because Draco is a rival. He's just generally suspicious about Draco. But it's funny that, you know, he's the one who is right about guessing Draco's motives about what he's doing this year. And it is funny to me that they don't, like, Hermione and Ron are dismissive, and they don't consider or seriously consider that it might be true that Lord Voldemort might have given Draco might have replaced his father as a Death Eater. Knowing, like, whenever has Lord Voldemort ever had a conscience not to sign up a Hogwarts student if it suits his purposes?
That is true. I think, if anything, to speak of, I just said this chapter is where Harry's obsession with Draco Malfoy begins truly. Like, obviously, when they go and see him in Borgin and Birks, he's like, oh my God. But this chapter literally opens with him, like, saying Harry spent a lot of the last week of the holidays pondering the meaning of Malfoy's behavior in Nocturne Alley. So literally, he's just like starting to just have that obsessiveness. But I think what you're saying is, what do you call it, it's in line with the character, in terms of Harry sometimes has gotten things wrong, at least in terms of like guessing things or being obsessed with certain theories.
Yes.
So Hermione and Ron sometimes might draw him back because they're thinking, well, mate, there are times when you've thought this, but it hasn't been that. And also with Draco, I think they are conscious. I like that Hermione and Ron aren't just yes people, like to Harry.
True.
They're not just like, let's go, because they have, it shows they're also their own individual characters, whereby they go, oh, you know what? Like, from, I guess, Ron's perspective, he'd be like, I hate Draco, but surely, you know, he's just an idiot, so why would the, you know, because he's not equating,
which is what he actually says, like, exactly. Why would Lord Voldemort, you know,
go for and then also Hermione would just be thinking, well, if Voldemort wants to have a plan of action, why would he have this student doing it? Because obviously they're using that naive viewpoint where they don't see what's, well, not naive, they don't know that Voldemort has been doing this more so as a test. I mean, we find this out later for why Draco is doing this thing, and he actually has been set up to fail anyway, and it's a punishment to the Malfoy family. But in regards to Harry and his obsession, it definitely is interesting how they do that. But it's interesting how it starts unfolding after this particular moment where he starts obsessing about the death. What is it called? What's the mark again? Oh God, I just forgot it.
Dark mark.
Yes, the dark mark. Yes. Does he have it? Does he not? Oh my God.
Yes.
But I was going to say, for me, I actually bookmarked this because it leans into my Harry and Ginny.
That is my next point. But go ahead. The queen of, what's their ship name? Do they have
a ship name? I hate their ship name because it sounds like a disease. Hinny is their ship name.
Okay, ma'am, go ahead and talk about Hinny.
Oh, it was more so, I just wanted to point out that one thing I love, there's an article, I think I've told you about this article, when I was trying to convince you to like Ginny and Harry back in the day, where I was saying one of the points that that particular writer noted was that Harry and Ginny connect. If people are wondering why Harry and Ginny connect, it's sometimes also down to their humor. They find similar things funny. Like, there are things that, for example, Harry might find funny that Hermione might not find funny, or Ron might find something funny, but maybe Harry will be like, I don't know if that's funny. But there's an interesting thread that JK now starts pulling. And I'm saying this purely from the fact that I want you to keep an eye on it, maybe when you're reading the rest of the chapters, because there's just little things that are dropped but they're not obvious on their face to say, oh, that's why they like each other. But it makes sense later, because I think that other writer that I talked about, she justified it by saying, at the end of the day, Harry is someone who's been through like a lot of darkness, and you kind of need someone who's just going to give you a laugh every 2 seconds, whatever. So Ginny kind of, what do you call it? Gives that point of view. Yeah, like she just gives that lightness, I suppose, from a perspective of comedy, really, rather than like putting light into his old order. But anyway, that's pretty much what I was just going to point out, because I just said that they just find the similar things funny about Fleur, like Fleur. I can never say her name, so I'll just botch it all the time. But I just love that they connect over that humor, and he couldn't have. You'll probably touch more on the moment what happens, because I've forgotten exactly how that scene unfolds, but that's the scene I was thinking of.
It's interesting you say that throughout this whole book you'll find these little moments in there that point to how and why they end up, you know, being together. But I'm like, every time, right, we start a new book in the series, I forget about Harry and Ginny being a canon ship, and I go back to not liking them as a couple. And, you know, I will say that I do like Ginny as a character. I think for me, that's been a very important part of me reading these books. Because honestly, not that I hated her in the films, like I just didn't care for her. She just wasn't a presence as she is in the books. Like you can feel her presence in the books more so, especially like, is it book two? Yes, book two with the Chamber of Secrets. But as we see glimpses of her here and there, like you feel her presence for me, particularly in book four, when she sees Harry in the library and they have that talk, that connection, for me, that was the moment. But there's a part like, you know, when Harry approaches her on the train so that they can find a compartment together. And Ginny's like, I'm meeting up with Dean. Mm. And then it says, and I quote, he, being Harry, felt a strange twinge of annoyance as she walked away, her long red hair dancing behind her. He had become so used to her presence over the summer that he had almost forgotten that Ginny did not hang around with him, Ron, and Hermione whilst the school. Mm. And I'm like, ah, we get it. Harry and Ginny sitting in a tree this season.
I love how you're just sort of like, you're like ticking boxes rather than like being excited or anything by it. I just love it. Because for me, it's more from a nostalgia perspective, right? I never was a potential Hermione and Harry person in the books. So I've never had that conflict whereby when people read the books, they might have to glean and find what they need to find about Harry and Hermione, because I've always just liked Harry and Ginny. So definitely it's interesting going back and reading and picking up some of those little things. And that's what I like about this book. It's not shoving romance. It's definitely one of the more romantic books. I even said, like, I'll mention it when we move on.
It definitely is. Like, as I said, I'm onto chapter, I finished chapter 14, and it's just a mess of hormones happening.
Pretty much. So this is now speaking to how Harry is now noticing, you know, I guess the other, what do you call it, the fairer sex?
Who is Cho Chang?
No. I'm not saying he's not noticing in book five. Sorry. You have to, okay, here's my point, Miss Lady Mary. If you remember, in book five, Harry was literally freaking out because he didn't even know what the Valentine's Day thing was going to be like. He was literally out of his depth, out of his element or whatever with Cho. I'm not saying he didn't notice any girl, because in book four, it starts the thread. But I feel like with Cho, it was like the awakening. And then now he's probably settling more into the idea of being someone who can admire other people without all the other, because I feel like book five, and there's so much darkness in that book. Like he's just conflicted every second of the day and whatnot. And then in book six, literally there's not much action that happens actually when I think about it, like up to the chapter that I'm at, that it sort of maybe gives him time to be like, oh, once in a while I'll notice her. But it might not even have been Ginny. It could have been Cho. It could have been anyone. But it's just that this book is structured to allow for the romance to come up for most characters. That's why Hermione and Ron have their little tiff.
Yes.
No, it's just easier to say Hermione and Harry than it is to say Hermione and Ron. It was a mistake. But either way, moving up, don't want to go too much about Ginny and Harry because they'll come up later. But I was going to say, though, when they were going into the compartment, because you mentioned it already, I do love that he's always a celebrity. Like, Harry is always a celebrity in any form. I wrote a couple of book potential titles that could be, because remember that there was that little gif about the potential titles for like students that just go to school with Harry. But for me, it was mostly from a humor perspective to be like, in book one, he's the boy who lived and young as Seeker. So people are like, oh my God, you know, fascinating guy. In book two, he's the boy suspected of being Slytherin's heir. In book three, he's the boy who's haunted by Dementors. In book four, he's the boy who somehow entered the Triwizard tournament and came back with a dead body. In book five, he's the boy who thought you know who is back. And then now he's the chosen one. So he can never not be a celebrity. Even if he's being a villain celebrity or he's being a hero celebrity, he is a celebrity. True. Like, oh,
God. True. Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. Do you know, by the way, I don't know, your page 129, this is totally going to annoy his listeners because they'll be like, why is that important? At page 129, I thought I noticed a typo. I've never noticed a typo in Harry Potter, or at least not that many. But at page 129, there's a part towards the bottom, I guess the last third of that page. It says, it starts off with saying, does anyone really know what you know who would or wouldn't do? I don't know if you see that part. Towards the bottom end of the page.
My book is set up differently because part for me at 120. You said on 129.
Yeah, 129.
No, that's not how this page starts.
Yeah. Not the page, but just the line that I want to refer to.
The line, okay. I see it.
Oh, yeah, but there's a point where it says, Mr. Weasley, I'm sorry, but isn't it worth investigating? If Malfoy wants something fixing and he needs to threaten Borgin, I was just like, does he mean something fixed? I don't know. It's just interesting. It's such a weird typo error that I noticed, but I just read it weirdly and I was like, oh, okay.
Wait, let me find it.
Missed editing.
What does yours say? If Malfoy wants something fixing.
Yeah. What does yours say?
Fixing.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. What does yours say? Threshing.
The same thing. I'm just saying, like, I wanted to know if it's a typo or maybe just some British way of saying something, or it just makes sense to me. Like, it doesn't read pronunciation wise, grammar wise, whatever.
If Malfoy wants something fixing.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm saying, shouldn't it be something fixed?
If my phone wants something fixed.
But anyway, it's just.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're right.
I thought, interesting. But anyway. Yeah. Oh, you've got the classic covers. I'll invest in those at some point in my future.
For your babies. Yes.
But yeah. If anything, girls still keep crushing on Harry. But then I picked up more about Neville. So it was a very good.
I found it even more funny about Luna. I'm like, she's trolling at this point. She's just trolling everybody around her.
She's too much that girl. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I feel like for me, it was mostly just pointing out like Neville's grandma being kind of proud of him for how he was a hero, because this whole time he's been like, my grandma probably doesn't like me, but he didn't realize maybe she was more pushing for him to be as courageous as his parents were. To a bit of an extreme degree because he was a kid. But I think him having his grandma support him is what maybe helps him to be the leader that he becomes in book seven, when he then has to, like, you know, be the rebel at school kind of thing, because his grandma is also rebelling on her end behind the scenes. But we'll get to that when we get to book seven. But
speaking of Neville, I'm curious to know, like, how much of what happens in the film is actually in the books. So when we get to that, that'll be something I will look into.
Nothing. That's what I'll tell you. Nothing. But now I'm just preempting. But also I was going to say, I found it interesting, when he just sort of asks or is disappointed that Harry isn't going to continue teaching, with Dumbledore's army and everything. But for me, the way Neville puts it across is what shows and is more proof that Harry should have been a teacher after leaving school, not always be an aura his rest of his life, whatever, how long he becomes an aura for. But the way Neville, I think, describes it is like, you know, it was good. He gave him confidence or whatever. I might be making it up. I'm not sure. But that's the general sentiment I thought that sentence said. And even later on, there's a sentence when Hermione remembers something that Harry said in the classes.
And she quotes him. Yeah.
So I'm like, that shows you're a great teacher when people can quote you back and people can, you know, anyway, it's missed opportunity by JJK.
I will continue saying that he should have been a teacher too. Being an aura, especially especially having defeated Voldemort already, it did not make sense for him to go back to something so... Something that he's been doing since he started school. Yeah.
It makes sense from the perspective that he can do it for a short period of time, because I'm sure there's a vacuum of power that happens or occurs when Voldemort leaves, but there's still people that are very much still in these beliefs and everything. You know, for example, if you think of real world examples, they always call it the denazification of Germany, because they had to actually literally educate people again to be like, no, the Nazi party's bad. This is why it's bad. And then get rid of like the symbolism that was used to, you know, whatever. So all those things, I think, if anything, I always love fanfics. I always say this, that touch on the immediate aftermath, what happens after Voldemort's gone, because we don't get that in the books enough. We just get, you know, a very brief glimpse. So I think he would have been there for maybe 5-10 years, who knows, thinking he needs to be there, and then he would have been like, oh, maybe I could try something else and get triggered to start this. But anyway, it is what it is. But I did want to say also on a Neville point, I did want to point out, I think Harry has a moment of reflecting on the prophecy and how Neville could have been the other chosen one. And I thought that was really nice of JK to kind of remind us that, yes, even though Harry is touted to be the chosen one, the idea of the prophecy isn't set in stone. And I think they keep emphasizing that later. I'm not sure if the chapters you're up to touch on it enough, but when we get to those chapters, I think I'll point it out in terms of what Dumbledore says about how the prophecy isn't in itself the thing that defines Harry and Voldemort's destinies. It's more Voldemort's choice that then tied these people together. So the prophecy was just, I guess, like a moot point. It was already going to eventuate. Well, it might not have eventuated, but the way Voldemort did it is the way that allowed Harry to be the one that gets tied up in this weird thing. But
because he didn't hear the whole prophecy. So he did, as you said, he did make a choice. But I was just thinking about it, like, it's a heavy thought to have for Harry, to think that he could have been the one having his parents alive, although if they would have suffered this same event, like, as Neville's parents, or maybe they could have just been alive and there for him, and he could have not been the one in the limelight like this for something like this.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Yeah.
I mean,
I wanted to say, in regards to chapter 7, like, hey, Harry is a damn idiot, right?
Mm.
But not to the level that he was in book 5. But still, like, what in the world? How in the world did he think he would go unnoticed in a compartment full of Slytherins? The fact how he even went into the room.
Is that on chapter 7 already?
Yeah, it's towards the end. Did you want to say something?
Oh, no, it was just because there was the slug club stuff that happened before. So I was like, wait, what?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Did we talk about that.
No, that's okay. You can keep going with the point. We can always revert back. Yeah. That's fine.
But anyway, even how he went into the room, he had to hold the door with his leg, then push Zabini inside. And then the fact that he, how does Draco notice him? I think he notices, like, when the invisibility clock sleeps or something, and it shows his leg or something when he's jumping.
he gets bumped by thingy crab's bag or something, and he makes a noise. So Draco would have noticed his trainer initially, but then he gets confirmation that there's someone up there.
I don't feel sorry for him. Like, when Draco catches him and hexes him, kisses him, like, he put himself in a very dangerous situation. But imagine if Harry, if this had been the events of book 7, and let's say all that war had broken whilst they were traveling to school, and Draco, someone gets a message to, like, you know, you need to bring Harry, he would have gotten him.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is also if Draco had not been on a redemption path and had not turned Harry in.
What? This is not fair.
It is fan fiction to me. Draco should have been redeemed. # But I was just gonna say, I'm actually surprised you didn't mention, you're Harry and Cho shipper too, but you did mention Harry kind of like, Cho kind of avoiding Harry. Like,
I saw that. I read it. I looked away and I did not see it, and I did not understand.
Girl, you're the one that's living in fan fiction land, because that ship sailed.
I am still bitter.
On Valentine's Day bitter. In The book five. Okay.
Well, we did not read that. All I know is what happened in book four and a bit of book five.
Oh, God. Oh, God. People that are... You're like an election denier in America. You're Harry and Ginny denier.
Wow.
But I was just going to say, so obviously, for me, what I love is that Slughorn's collection.
Yeah.
It's interesting because obviously... For Neville, it's because of his lineage. That shows Slughorn loves to collect people that have that history, wizarding family history. And then Blazer Beanie for me was very funny because I have been literally obsessed with Blazer Beanie and Theonaut purely from fan fiction. But it's so hard to read them as just like 2D characters who are just like, you know, villainous. Right?
Like in my head, like, I have to like, no. In canon, they're not the way they
are. Like, they're not like the, you know, either the cheerful Blaze who's supporting Draco and Hermione, at least in my Draco and Hermione land, or just Theonaut who sometimes shipped with Harry, or just being like a best friend to Draco. Like, it's just interesting not to see those dynamics not played out, but it's fine. But I did also love that Ginny kind of gets involved. Not loved. I found it interesting that Ginny gets involved in this slug club because Slughorn sees her doing something that he considers to be like very talent based or whatever. Because for me, isn't it weird though? And this is something that people have mentioned. First of all, I think I forgot to mention the point about Harry noticing Ginny's red hair, like when she's walking somewhere.
I mentioned it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So when he says that, that's also another thing that reminds him of his, well, not reminds him, but is like his mum. Like his mum had red hair.
Thank you for saying that. Yes.
And then, oh, trust me, I've never not accepted that. That's weird because no. It is weird. But I've just found it interesting that as you read more and you pay attention more, you're like, oh, God, it really is full on blatant. And this is one of those examples because Lily, one of the reasons why Slughorn liked her was because she was naturally talented in potions. So it's another connection to Lily that I'm like, I don't know.
Not potions, charms, wasn't it?
I'm not sure, but she was. I thought it was potions because he's a potions master.
Oh, true that. Yeah. Oh, okay. Charms.
But
no, I don't know if it's fanfic.
No, but I think she would have been talented in a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I think Slughorn was a potions teacher, so he would have related. But either way, I just found it funny that like that connection is constantly being made about him and his mum, and it's weird. It's really weird. But other than that, really, I thought the Slughorn chapter was. The Slug Club chapter was pretty solid in the way it ends, like you said.
Yeah.
With the revenge. And picking up from that, I did want to ask you, though, as a predominantly film watcher, because you did say you'd only read these books once, I was very shocked when you admitted. I was like, what?
I'm still a fan.
I know. Obviously, through and through. But as a predominantly film watcher, did you remember that Harry had been saved by Tonks? Because chapter 8 picks up straight up from Harry...
No, for a moment I was really, I'm like, I know he ends up at Hogwarts, but how does he get out of the train?
I know. I was kind of, I mean, I always do get surprised, especially after the sixth film and how that goes with Luna being the one that sort of sees him. Mm. But yeah, I was kind of like, oh yeah, Tonks saves him. Interesting.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if it logically makes sense because I think what justification did she give for finding him?
Oh, because the order is patrolling, like
they were there.
So when they didn't see him get out of the train, that's when Tonks got onto the train.
But also Tonks is a very interesting character. I mean, she continues to be like she's put in very small chapters, but I love how, from a reader's perspective, I mean, I don't know if it's hindsight or we already kind of have the hints, but we know why she's the way she is. I think it's partly because she's pregnant, or is it because her and Lupin are sort of, Lupin is like not wanting to be in a relationship with her and debating about it and stuff like that or whatever. Wait, sure, is she pregnant yet or no?
Was this a fanfic you were telling me about where Harry walks in?
And she's changing into Sirius. Yes. Yeah, I think that was a fanfic, yes. Yeah. Yes. But in this one, he does think that her Patronus has changed to something big and he thinks it's like Sirius's Patronus. I mean, or Sirius's dog form, whatever.
Yes.
But it's not. It's actually Lupin. But it's, yeah. It's just interesting how she keeps weaving that story so that by the time we get to book 7, or I think by the end of book 6, they then say, oh, you know, she's with Lupin. But it's just dropped in hints.
Yeah, I think I remember that. I think Hermione is the one who said, like, how could as in how could we have not noticed, or something like that.
So yeah, it's just interesting. But yeah, I don't know if you have any more points about Snape and Snape's
Snape just being Snape, man.
Oh my god, I always say he should know better. No matter how much these kids annoy the hell out of him, he should know better. He should not put
He hates Harry. There's nothing about, especially he hated Harry, right? There was no doubt about that. But his hate was sort of like yeah, I hate this kid because of his parent father. He's his father, exactly. But Harry's behavior last year completely cemented that belief for him. How could Harry jump into that pansy?
I know.
That boy. But speaking about Harry's dumbness, can we move on to chapter 8?
We're already in chapter 8.
Well, it kind of flows, like, because when Tonks finds Harry, I think it's the end of chapter 7.
No, it is chapter 8.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying as in chapter 8 literally starts with Tonks finding Harry.
Oh, really?
Yes.
But that he put himself in a stupid situation. He definitely feels it more when he walks into the Grey Hall and Ron and Hermione are asking him what happened. And I caught, he's like, "Not now, Hermione," said Harry in Ed darkly tone. Hey, I was listening to it on Audible and I let it dictate onto the computer, but said Harry in a darkly significant voice. He hoped very much that they would all assume he had been involved in something heroic, preferably involving a couple of Death Eaters.
He didn't want
Harry
to be known
kills
to.
Me. It's funny sometimes.
He didn't want to be known to have been caught by Mr. Draco Malfoy.
Yeah,
that is true. That is true. It's pretty interesting. But I think what I found funny as well was when he says no, when Snape is like called out as the dark arts teacher,
yes, and his reaction is
like no. Like, I mean, I can't say it as loudly on this microphone, but I'm sure had we been there in the Great Hall, it would have been like very loud and very obvious.
That it's so dramatic,
Mr. Snape. But that's the thing, right? You kind of from a pure perspective of having Dumbledore strategizing, it is a strategy for him to have Snape there now, in the sense that
how,
for me, I've always thought Dumbledore, I think, is acknowledging that he's going to die, first of all, because he already knows he's going to die, but he needs to get Slughorn back somehow. Slughorn is not a dark arts teacher in many ways. I don't know if now it's conjecture. I don't know when he would have made the decision, let's just say, because it's either he got cursed by the ring, because I think Harry sees him with the ring, with the hand burnt.
By when he picks him up,
So it's either this is something that has already been in the works, not so much like a master plan. I don't think he sat down and it's like, Snape has to be the teacher in Harry's sixth year. But I think it just worked out that way because perhaps Dumbledore was seeing that if he gave Snape the dark arts teacher role anytime before that, it wouldn't take away from the fact that he's trying to be playing double agent in some way, for me anyway. Because I feel like if he'd been a dark arts teacher, the Order of the Phoenix members would have been like, well, he's already like there, like recruiting people for the kids, I mean, for his master. So they probably wouldn't believe in Dumbledore's vision for Snape, in Dumbledore's own belief in Snape as much as possible or whatever. But then I also think, if anything, because it's interesting, they don't really do many dark arts classes in this book. So perhaps my theory might be a bit off, but
see a lot of more, like, all the other subjects.
I think we only have one or two dark arts classes, which is very interesting. But I think partly, I mean,
do you feel like it was also more for the sake of maintaining the double agent role, in that it might show that, you know,
so now Dumbledore, he's there,
he's Snape.
Yes. I think that is actually much better. Like, you landed on what I was trying to say, like, earlier, to say, like, him not being the dark arts teacher for this time was just Dumbledore's plan as well, and then now it is more so Dumbledore's plan to be like that way. He makes it look as if Snape is double crossing Dumbledore, even though technically Snape is triple crossing Voldemort or something like that, because there's a lot of crossing that's going on with Snape at the moment. But I just thought to pick, because I was like, at the end of the day, this is something he's always wanted. Well, wanted, people say, but now he's got it.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? But yeah, anyway, it was a pretty quick chapter. I mean, if anything, I think Dumbledore's speech, I want to know how that is when he talks to the kids about the gravity of the situation and everything. I want to compare it to the movie. Not compare it because I think the movie was better or the book is better, but I think in the book he does touch, in the film, there is a mention of like Tom Riddle or whatever. So I'm interested to see how that speech plays out in the film. Yeah. As compared to, what is it called? To the book. But yeah. And obviously Hagrid thinking they're going to be in care of
Magic. Oh, that was so precious. And then he gives them the cold shoulder and then he's giving them the cold shoulder for a while and he's ignoring them. Then they have to go and apologize.
I mean, Hagrid, come on. Really? Come on.
Hey, in third year alone.
I know.
The kid got injured, even if it's Malfoy and it was his own fault. But the type of creatures he finds interesting as a very dangerous.
Exactly. Like, you know what? One would think this Fantastic Beast series should have had Hagrid in it rather than
Yes,
Ficken.
Yes. And the fact that when Hagrid is he aware? I think he's gone away, like on a mission from Dumbledore. And Grubbly Planks takes over. Mm-hmm. And all of them, even Harry, has to admit that he actually does enjoy the class.
Because it's taught in a more structured way rather than he is the most nefarious beast ever. Oh, he's cute and adorable. Like, oh my God.
Yeah.
But then for me, I love that it continues on the romance, or at least I should say Homon's raging path, because I pick up chapter 9 purely because Lavender giggles at something that Ron does, and Ron kind of just like basks in the glory of that moment or something. I'm just like,
literally, he's getting the attention that he wants, right?
It's some interaction that happens where Hermione confiscates something from a first year, and then Ron takes it, and he does something, I can't remember. But then it says Hermione's remonstration was drowned by a loud giggle. Lavender Brown had apparently found Ron's remark highly amusing. Because, he says, excellent, I've always wanted one of those, which is the most non-funny line ever. But clearly, girls crashing. And then he says, she continued to laugh as she passed them, glancing back at Ron over her shoulder. Ron looked rather pleased with himself. And there begins what will soon become Won-Won and whatever her name is, Lavender's name for him. But yeah, it's a very I like how it's set up. It's
I can't wait for us to get to the chapters where I point out that Ron Weasley is a red flag walking.
Oh, tell me about it. That's what people always argue. I mean, I always say this, I think she should end up with Draco, but anyway, that's just
This is the book that will grate. Well, they don't end up together in this book, but book 7 will truly kill you.
Exactly. Yeah. It will truly kill me. And mind you, I'm not even against Ron and Hermione. I'm just like you, recognizing more and more to be like, what qualities exactly does Ron in? And that's not to say Ron is a bad. Ron, love him for his just general being, not the guy that is put up as the hero. I think I point this out later on, but like, I will touch on it more then, but I just like that he's there as not a foil, but he balances out the brilliantness of Hermione plus the brilliantness of Harry from like just being purely someone who's just courageous and impulsive and whatever. But then
he functions on instinct when he's doing magic, as opposed to Hermione's brilliance. Yeah. And Sorry to cut you off, but I feel like Ron is more like the person who has grown up and lived in this wizarding world. So he functions on the basis of like someone who knows
sort of the logic of what should happen or not happen or respect. Oh, he's got a better understanding, I guess, of if something is unfolding. This is probably why. That's why we get annoyed, or I get annoyed at the character assassination of him in the films, because he doesn't show his brilliance sometimes, because he's not like people end up trashing on him so much because of whatever reasons they have. But I think for me, he's a good character to have as a best friend, you know, because there are times when he clashes with Harry and clashes with Hermione. And it's purely what friendships are. Like, you clash and you get along.
And Harry and Hermione have clashed too, especially when they were fighting over the broom that Sirius
exactly. And Ron's jealousy and stuff speaks to a lot of us in our emotions sometimes when you're just purely envious of someone else being perceived as better. Not that Harry is better than Ron.
But Ron takes it to another level,
that's
though.
That's the thing.
We will get into it, but Ron takes it to another level for sure.
Yeah, we can continue on that one later. But
I will say, speaking to Ron's smarts as well, I remember in first year when they're going through the 3 or 4 trials set up by the teachers to get to the Philosopher's Stone, and they're going through the Devil's Snare, and Hermione is like, like, we need light and whatnot or something like that.
Don't have
and
wood.
She's struggling there, don't have a match, whatnot. And Ron is like, are you not a witch?
Literally. He's less of the I need a book to understand what's going
he's
on.
Practical,
yeah,
he's
very practical. Much so. And he's funny, and I feel like for me, I would not take away anything from someone who is just funny. Like the lines he says, he's got some of the best funniest lines in the book.
Yeah.
I'll never forget.
I think the problem with being the funny guy or the funny girl, especially depicted when we see movies and TV shows, and it's always the black woman or the black or the black guy who are the funny guy, and that's all that they ever are. They've got no depth to them, but Ron does have depth to him,
and can be very dark.
There's
you're
shallow,
right,
but depth.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm just hating on him, but like
I was actually surprised at how well we were going with you defending him, and now you're just
I gotta hate on him somehow.
Just gotta undercut. It's fine. We'll do proper character analysis at the end of this whole review, and we'll talk a little bit more about Ron. Yeah. But anyway, I was gonna say, so obviously this one unfolds more as the when they're getting into their first class and all that stuff, and they're happy about getting a free period. I remember being very happy about getting a free period when I was in high school. I was like, oh, free period. But all you got to do is study in that free period. So it's a little bit whatever. And obviously Snape is still who he is. But then Harry always has something to say. I don't know if you picked that one up and you want to talk about it, or you have something else to talk about before you get to Harry being sassy back to Snape. Do you remember the chapter, the part that I'm talking about?
Sorry, say that again.
What happened? I was saying the part
I was
Harry
reading, not trying to
or find or scan
what I wanted to say next, but sorry.
No, it was about Harry being sassy back to Snape, but yes, I didn't want to say it in case you had that as a line. I don't want to take away everything.
I don't know. Continue.
Oh, it was just when they're doing the shield charm spells and stuff, and then he knocks Snape over.
And he's like sorry, sir. No, he doesn't say sorry.
No, he doesn't even say sorry.
About saying, sir, you don't have to call me, sir.
Yeah. He's just like, do you remember me telling you we were practicing non-verbal spells, Potter? Because he does the Protego spell as a non-verbal, which knocks Snape off his feet. And then Harry's like, yes. And then Professor Snape is like, yes, sir. And then Harry's like, there's no need to call me, sir, Professor. And detention
on Saturday. Given a detention, like this boy, just... like he never learns. Like he has to find a teacher that he's always antagonistic towards. And Snape has been true and tried. Like if I was Harry Rice, I'd be laying a little bit low, considering like
oh gosh.
But then I think we're also forgetting something. Not forgetting, but also not pointing out the fact that, especially when Harry sees Snape for the first time, when he meets them at the gate, when Tonks drops Harry off. And as soon as Harry sees Snape, like a blinding rage, hatred, like burns through him, because he thinks about how Snape was also, or believes that Snape was also instrumental in getting Sirius killed. So he hates. The hatred is mutual, but he hates Snape.
It's kind of humbling how by the end of the book series, he ends up calling one of his kids after him. So, it's a very big 360.
We're going to talk about how those kids were named.
I know. Oh, trust me. That's the biggest joke,
right?
That's the biggest joke.
What was JK thinking?
We'll talk about it
I understand the sentiment, especially if you're reading the books, right? And you're like, oh, he named these kids after so and so and so. Oh, the emotion behind it, especially when he names his kid, he names the kid Severus, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Albus Severus.
Yeah, yeah. Damn, heavy names, but you understand why JK did it like that. He's doing it for the fans, like, you know, who now see that Snape was a good guy and Harry's behavior towards him, or actually their behavior towards each other, and just want some sort of like reminder of like, you know, yeah, that things were good. That was it. So probably that's why she did it, JK.
I don't know. Oh, no. Definitely, it was done from a sentimentality perspective. But people, we end up reading too much into things sometimes. And that's not to say it's bad for us to read too much into things, but we end up applying real world logic to stories. And it doesn't make sense if we do that, because at the end of the day, there's reasons why an author does what they do. It's their story. Mm-hmm. We're just there to consume it. So we can laugh and cackle, but we just got to respect it. And I respect it. Like you said, Albus Severus, and it ends up being a character that is interesting in terms of how even in fan fiction people portray the kid, because he's sort of like, even in the chapter, anyway, we'll talk about it, but it's even,
I'm actually not really been interested in reading like their future kids fanfic, like,
I haven't read future kids fanfic, but I'm saying as in the thread of how in the 19 years later chapter, look at us jumping to the end of the book, but the 19 years later chapter, you feel how Albus is more introspective, but he seems very intelligent as well. And then James is kind of like the jokester, and he's named after two jokesters, I suppose, in terms of James and Sirius.
Where was Ginny when all these kids
were
named?
That's what people always question, but they named her Luna, so I guess Luna.
Where
Ginny,
was Ginny? Like,
I'm sure, but I think it's just I take it from her honoring certain characters that were instrumental or key in Harry's journey, and I guess. True. Yeah, but anyway, not to digress too much, we then go on to the fact that they go to the potions class. That was the next thing. But I was going to say, look at me going back to the films. In the films, it does play out a little bit differently, and we'll talk about it when that happens. But them getting the books, so that, I know there's things that happen in between them, but I just wanted to highlight that. Them getting the books is funny because it's kind of just by coincidence that they both get these old copies of the books, and Harry's happens to be the Half-Blood Prince book. So it's kind of like, I get it from a conventional storytelling where you're not wanting to make your book. There's something called a MacGuffin or something, which like becomes like an object that people either hunt for or look for in a story. And it sort of takes its own importance in some ways. So I like how she sort of introduces the Half-Blood Prince book in a very like, you know, you kind of got a book and you happen to get the book.
Throwaway kind of.
But that's the throwaway line. But in the movie, I loved it better because they fight over the book. And it's funny because it's like Ron wanted the newer copy and also Harry wanted the newer copy. He wants an old copy of a book. But then Harry loses the battle and gets the book. So it's just funny. I feel like it was one of the best comedic scenes out of that movie, which it's a problematic movie. But yeah, I always remember that scene because Daniel Radcliffe and Rupert Grint just did it so well. So I kind of have that as the preceding memory for this particular thing, but anyway, let's move on talking about Slughorn.
I was gonna say Harry getting that book, that and the way he is defensive about the book toward when Hermione, you know, is like, you know, you shouldn't be using that book or following instructions from the book and stuff like that, and the irony of Harry being defensive and benefiting unknowingly, of course, off of Snape's book.
Definitely.
It's hilarious.
That is true. That is, there's a lot of irony in him definitely becoming the king of potions. That's what I think. There's a point where Snape kind of like questions Harry's brilliance when Slughorn talks about this. It comes up a little bit later when the Christmas party happens, but it is very funny. But if anything, I also picked up that it was interesting that when he walks into the classroom, the Amortentia spell potion, is brewing. So then he smells flowers, and then he gets confirmed that the source of the flowery scent is Ginny.
Please.
I just did that to annoy you.
As I said, I'm only up to end of chapter 14, but I'm just this ball of confusion and conflicted over the Ginny and Harry element of it.
That's the thing.
Like,
it's actually interesting. I'm up to chapter 24.
I'm like, no.
I'm up to chapter 24, and I can tell you that, anyway, I won't spoil it. Let's just, you uncover up to chapter 24, but yeah, it's quite interesting. Like, what actually the story? It's very slow build in terms of, like, it's not obvious. She doesn't even, yeah, it's not a romance book, so whatever. We can't expect her to do wonders for romance. People do complain sometimes to be like, her romance can be clunky, but I think she's portraying teenagers. Like, what else are they going to be other than awkward and weird? And yeah, I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't think I had much more other than the fact that Hermione gets annoyed at Harry winning over using the book, and she doesn't listen to him when he suggests to say, use this strategy, but she's so much about following the letter.
But yes,
that she's just like, no. But it did remind me to not mention a Dramini fic, but there's a fic which I read where which is called Measure of a Man.
And now I know everything about Measure of a Man.
And
man,
you really need to read it. I wish I had not even told you enough, and I just
you said a lot about this fanfic.
But this fanfic touches, like I told you, it's like the writer read all of Harry Potter first, and then decided to take bits and pieces and build the characters off that, and just really beautiful. But anyway, in this fic, it is about Hermione sort of taking on this healer journey. She's a healer and all that stuff. But Draco, I'm not sure if this is a fanfic related thing or it's a book related thing, but apparently Draco is good at potions generally in fanfic. That's how people portray him. So then in this book, in this fanfic, they do touch on the fact that even though Hermione is a good healer, she is too precise sometimes with the way she does her healing and potion making, that sometimes she doesn't want to, all she can do is follow the recipe, right? But then that limits maybe the potency of her potion, or, you know, how effective it could be, because part of, I guess, cooking and all that stuff is experimenting. That way you know the flavors and all that stuff. So it's kind of a similar thing. And Draco kind of touches on the fact that she has to just let go of the book. So it's like not a funny thread, but it's just an interesting thread that happens with the story, where like Hermione's defiance to always follow the book kind of like works against her. But it's funny because it's like, oh, it touches on her old high school days of reading the book and following the letter of the law. And yeah,
man, the crack ship is strong with being
I know I have converted to Dramini, so I think you can convert to Dramini.
I can see it happening. I can definitely see it happening, and I know maybe eventually I will read it, but it's not gonna happen now.
No, that's true. Yeah. But also, you did touch on what Hermione said about following instructions from a book, but Ginny does touch on the fact that, you know, like, if you want to continue.
How did I not mention that?
It was just about how.
No, I didn't write anything about that, but I did take like a mental note that, you know, also Ginny gets at Harry about, like, you know, considering the events of, you know, with Brito's diary, how can you be taking? Because she walks in on them talking about this, and she immediately is like, how are you taking instructions from a book? Did you not learn from our experience? And she is concerned about him. And I'm like, I'm sure Audrey is eating this up as I'm reading this. Like, I'm like, please.
I'm only picking it up from a perspective of building the Ginny and Harry narrative.
I know. I don't know why. I can see all these moments, right? And if I was like a hardcore Harry and Ginny shipper, I would have been eating it up. I know, I would have been eating it up.
That's the thing. I honestly, I don't know why, but my memory of reading the old, like the books before, I know book six, like I've said, I've read it a lot more because from a Ginny and Harry perspective, I especially reread some chapters when they do get together. But I actually don't remember picking up these many little moments which just hint at like him being interested in her. Not so much her being interested back, but just him being interested in her. I think
even in saying that, Audrey, like, how much he's noticing of her, how much we're actually how much more we're glimpsing of Ginny than we have in the other books, that sometimes we barely see her. As you said, it's written, I keep on forgetting how you...
Yeah, that narrative perspective. I always forget too.
Yeah.
I think it's like third person limited or something. I can't remember the...
Yeah, so we're getting things mostly unless we move to a different location, and JK wants to, especially in book four, when we started at with Riddle and all that. But we're now hearing from the story is from Harry's perspective. So we are getting more glimpses of Ginny, meaning that he's noticing her more.
That's true. That's true.
And I'm like, I hate it. But I like
I've never seen someone who's such a denier of something that's already happening on the page.
I know by the end of this book, I'm just going to be admitting things like, hey, I was wrong. And I already know I'm going to be saying that.
Yeah. But mind you, I've never also completely dismissed Harry and Hermione, right? Because the movies, I'm talking from the movies perspective. The movies, I can see why. Because I remember even from the third movie going, could they be together? But that was because I hadn't read the book at the time.
What was it in the third book?
You protect her from the werewolf or whatever. Yeah, so there is definitely more of a push in the movies than there is in the book. So,
That they made that choice in the movies.
Yeah. So it's the conflict for me comes from the fact that when I read canon, I don't really see Hermione and Harry together, like in that sense. Like I see them as companions in terms of their friendship, and Hermione is always challenging Harry. But it's the way that Harry sometimes just gets annoyed at Hermione being right, and I'm like, you shouldn't. It's not a foundation.
Wait, doesn't Ron do that too?
No, Ron does that. But what I'm saying is from Harry and him, that's why I'm saying now also Ron and Hermione, problematic as hell. I want it to be Draco right now. And that's not to say Draco is any better.
Wait, pause. This is a very important moment, Audrey.
You mock me.
You get at me for like, how can you not see Ron and Hermione and whatnot?
You
don't even read Ron and Hermione fanfic. And you just admitted that, Ron and Hermione are problematic.
They're problematic in the sense that it makes sense why in fan fiction people have them be together initially and then they break up. Because I think Hermione, whether it's by design of how JK was writing the story, I think there's just a moment or perspective where she eliminates Harry as potential, like in terms of like her interest in him potentially. And maybe there's just that push and pull that she has with Ron that, typically, those are the perfect ingredients for starting some kind of romantic connection. She doesn't really have that with Harry. With Harry, they're like-minded. They usually think the same. If anything, they just clash on ideals or ideology about certain things. But with Ron and Hermione, it's like literally purely they just do not get along sometimes. And it's just weird to see. But I can see where the fruits of the romance comes through. But that's why it should have just been a high school up to just post, defeating Voldemort. type thing. I can definitely see why people do tend not to have them together, and whether that could then have meant she would be with Harry later or with Draco later with another guy, who cares? She could have just been by herself and be Minister of Magic either way. But I think what I'm trying to say is I'm now realizing that there are times when Ron says some comments and you're like, oh my god, had he been like in his 20s and saying this to her, we would just be like livid, the way that he reacts. But let's just read it for the fun. Forget about real world logic.
I'm just happy that you freely admitted this on your own.
Mind you, I didn't freely admit it. You forced me into admitting it.
That's what I believe you said. So
It's also because there are times when you pick up, like when he's in a relationship with Lavender and stuff. I'm like, he's very insensitive. But anyway, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's okay. Yeah. He's a stupid little guy. Let's move on to one of my favorite chapters, the first memory of Voldemort and his ancestors. The House of Gaunt chapter, unless you had something else to say.
I do have something like, when I can't remember why Harry was outside of Gryffindor, but I think he bumps into Trelawney and she's mumbling out loud, doing a card reading, right? I'm wondering if her card reading predicted anything. So she says, Two of Spades. Conflict, Seven of Spades, an ill omen, Ten of Spades, violence, Knave of Spades, a dark young man, possibly troubled, one who dislikes the questioner. It feels like she kind of predicted something.
I'm not sure, but it's good to go. There is a thing that I think I shared before where I was saying how many of Trelawney's prophecies did she actually get right? I'm not sure if that's one of them. I don't know. I don't think I even picked that up. I mean, I remember that happening, but I don't think I picked it up enough to search.
I was going to search, but then I got...
Because I know she got right the one about... 13 people at the table and the first one to stand is the one who dies, and it was Dumbledore who rose up or something to say hi to her and he died first in like the the makeup of the people that were at that Christmas table. This was like in book one or two or something. And obviously she got right the one about Sirius and obviously Harry's prophecy. But I can't remember which if she got the card one right, but it's worth
I'll actually look it up whilst you move on to another point.
Yeah, I was just, oh, she actually, no, you're right. She meets him. You're confusing me. She says this in the next chapter, which is the chapter we're talking about. So anyway.
Yes.
No, I thought you were saying, wait, we're still talking about chapter 9 when I said let's move on to chapter 10.
And then I moved on to chapter 10.
Oh, your move on to chapter 10 was very much like, wait. I'm like, okay. So you thought I was already going to start talking about the House of Gaunt in terms of actually talking.
I was saying moving on to the chapter.
So anyway, what I was going to say was, so the lessons with, apologies listeners, a little bit disjointed because of Tinashe's disorganization. I'm just kidding.
I'm going to be erasing all of this.
But so I call the lessons with Dumbledore, you know, pretty much a trip down memory lane for, if you call Voldemort's memories anything to be excited about. But I think, if anything, Harry is very much still naive at this point. Even after the prophecy, I feel like Harry, because of how Dumbledore is still withholding a lot of information from him.
Yep.
Harry is very much still naive as to his role, his true role in all of this. Yes, he's found out that he has to defeat Voldemort, but I don't think it's fully sunk in, because for him, he's probably just seeing him and Voldemort coming up to an arena somewhere and, like, you know, battling it out. But he obviously
and that's what all of them are thinking, especially when he first goes to these lessons.
He's like, what am I going to be taught? Am I going to be taught defensive spells? Blah, blah, blah. But definitely the gravity of what's going on, it as much as obviously it unfolds a bit later with the Horcruxes and stuff, with him finding out what they are exactly, I do love that we do get to learn about Voldemort in these patches of weird randomness. Because, to be honest, even speaking to real life history, there is something about how villainous characters always have, or very villainous kind of villainous people in history always have very shady backgrounds. Like Hitler, for example, there's very little about his growing up years. Like, yeah, there's some, but it's not a lot. So in terms of how he was molded to be evil, it's not always like clear, as in, like, you know, there's a connecting thread throughout the thing. And then similarly, even like if you think of like some dictators that came after, because I watched a lot of history documentaries, there is always some missing history about who was this person as a child? Why are they the way they are, kind of thing? Because it always is a psychology based study whereby people say, what is your inner child like, right? Like, you know, how were you raised to affect how you are as an adult? So by going through Voldemort's history, it's very interesting how, in effect, even Dumbledore says we have to make up threads and connect them and, you know, make them make sense based on this little that we have, because this is a person that did his best to stay low but still be doing things that kind of like built him up to be who he was. But that thread, I did ask, I was like, I mean, well, first of all, we do get confirmation that they physically drop into the pensieve. Like, remember how I said, I don't know if they...
Yes. I made a note of that physically? Too. Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know if you have some... I was just going to ask, like, a question before we move on to the rest of the memory. But I guess wanted to ask you, because obviously we get to see the memories is Dumbledore and Harry going back and seeing Merop, Gaunt, whatever her name is, Morphin, and the other father or the brother, I can't remember. But, and I think Mavolo. So yes. they all meet, they all live in this like dirty, grubby cabin somewhere near where the Riddles were killed. So I wanted to ask, is Merop a bad person, or was she just a young girl who knew no better in terms of like hoodwinking Tom Riddle? Obviously, we find that out a little bit later. Or is Tom Riddle Sr. a bad person? Or was he just also a person who was justified in being angry at being hoodwinked?
I actually was going to ask this question, then I removed it because I'm like, Merop grew up in a very terrible environment and situation, and she is a product of her environment. The parenting that Marvolo, parenting style that he had towards his children, the way he favored one and the other one was really abusive towards her, that it even affected her magic sometimes. To what extent, we're also guessing, like Dumbledore. And so when she saw this man, right, she's like, you know, she falls in love. And whether he's in love or not, we know he's not. She definitely makes bad choices. She definitely makes bad choices. And again, she probably initially does not see like the wrongness in a situation because, again, of she's maybe something that's from her, from how she was parented. Yeah. And not to say that all Slytherins or all people descended from Slytherin are bad people, but you can tell from a situation that, you know, it was bad. So definitely made a wrong choice in giving a potion to Tom Riddle, but made an even worse evil choice now when we assume that forced him to sleep with her. Yeah,
that's true.
Essentially rape. Yeah, essentially rape.
Well, and that is true. So, I mean, I wasn't even thinking of it that darkly either, but yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah. I that's why initially I was about to put the question down. Then I'm like, it can really go to a dark place. Like,
No, that's true. It can
really
true.
Go to a dark place. That's yeah.
In saying that, it is interesting to say that I did say, like, I love how we get to obviously understand Voldemort's, the root of Voldemort's cruelty, even though I was talking about how it can be hard to piece those threads together. But we can also put it down, like you said, not everyone in Slytherin is the house of Hogwarts. Is evil, obviously. It's just that these books unfortunately kind of don't have enough nuance sometimes, I think, to allow for us to have that shade of gray with these characters. But in regardless though, the Slytherin line inherently was very much based or rooted in blood, you know, being blood purity and all that stuff to an even more fanatical extent than every other pure blood family probably was. And I think over time that definitely corrupted how they view, because obviously they look at Merope admiring this handsome guy as like something that's already makes her like a blood trader, even though she hasn't had at that time. I remember in this memory there's a thing where they call her a squib, a blood trader, even though she hasn't yet been with Tom Riddle, but they already see her admiring someone who's of that muggle, whatever, as being something that is against their value system. And yet look at where they live. They didn't benefit from being Slytherin's heirs. No, they just happened to be holding on to this legacy that they didn't even get to be a part of or build or whatever. But it's just easier to hold on to that idea of like, oh, we're better than the rest and you have nothing else to root yourself in. So if anything, I don't think, like you said, Merope is inherently bad or Tom is inherently bad. I just think the situation was not good. But what I then find interesting is there is a lot of children that are born in bad situations. And I'm now talking about Tom Riddle in the sense that you can be naive and just say, oh, it's because his parents didn't love each other. That's why he had no love in his heart. But I think if anything, Harry is then a good indicator of how one can be. Obviously, he was born by loving parents and all that stuff, but he grew up in a very terrible situation, similar to Tom Riddle. But he wasn't an evil person. He didn't let that corrupt him kind of thing. And that's the contrast that I love about the Half-Blood Prince. It allows us to see how much of Harry is similar to the old Tom Riddle before he really, truly became Voldemort. And even Harry at some point is like recognizing how, you know,
the similarities.
Yeah, the similarities. So it's chilling to also think if we're thinking back on how the Neville dynamic when he was like, oh, you know, I could have been Neville, Neville could have been me. It's also similar to Tom Riddle. If he had let hate and just general ego, and I don't know how him as a kid got this ego, but I suppose a little bit of fear, a little bit of not knowing, and then not having a good role model to model yourself after, probably didn't help. Because I feel like if Harry had continued to not be in Hogwarts and have people like Dumbledore and then meet Sirius and Lupin later, he probably would have just been like, you know, obviously he wouldn't have gone to the Wizarding World, but he wouldn't probably have turned out the way he did, obviously, in terms of from a character perspective, not so much the things that happen around him. So I just, I find that interesting from this book onwards. It kind of just starts putting them side by side in terms of like really comparing their upbringings and how they've turned out as different people as a result of that as well. So,
I also wanted to point out, like, just going back before they even jump into the pensive, like moving away from the morbidness of the conversation, but just Harry's hilarious reaction to seeing the pensive. And it says his previous experiences with the odd device, though highly instructive, had also been uncomfortable. The last time he had disturbed its contents, he had seen much more than he would have wished. Referring to the last time where he saw Snape being bullied by his father and, you know, Sirius egging him on and Remus being a bystander to it. But Dumbledore was smiling. This time you enter the pensieve with me, even more unusually, with permission. The permission part was really funny to me. But there's another part. So when Dumbledore is trying to open the stopper on the bottle holding the memory before he pours it into the pensieve, he is struggling just to twist the cap, right? Yeah. And him struggling physically to do something that doesn't require a lot of strength, like pulling out the stopper on the vial. And he's using his injured hand. Like, it left me really deep in my feels, because for the first time, I think we're really seeing some of Dumbledore's personality come through right from the moment we see him at the Dursleys, where he's cracking jokes, he's being sassy, he's being snippy, he's being funny, he's defending Harry, he's being a little bit open with Harry. To a certain extent, of course, he's not saying everything, but we're just seeing glimpses of the man, a part of the man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And which us as an audience are reading into as well. So, and then it makes me sad, because I know what's coming. I'm like, where was all this when we had the chance? So I was like, Harry observes that his injured hand seems stiff and painful. And every time that it's mentioned, I feel sad, especially so when they're in the Great Hall. When Harry finally joins them, and when Dumbledore is making the welcome speech, and everyone notices the arm. I'm not sure if everyone picks up on the arm, but especially the trio notices arm, and they're like, "Oh, what happened? And Hermione says, "It looks as if it's died." And I'm like, I think I'm already dreading and grieving what's to come. Like, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Dumbledore is a fascinating character for me, so I'm more
absolutely
sort of looking
like.
For-
Yeah, I think there was a part in third year, at the end of third year or at the end of fourth year, it must have been end of fourth year, where we read that his eyes gleamed. Yeah, I'm like, I don't like this man.
Even later on in this book, there's moments where I think, I always say this, like, of all the characters in Harry Potter, Dumbledore is by far the most fascinating for me in terms of, you can look at Voldemort and everything and he's complicated and he's whatever, but it's more so how Dumbledore can also be looked at as having very shady reasons for doing what he was doing. And it's just, we'll definitely get to that a lot more. But his planning and masterminding and everything, it is borderline maniacal or like Machiavellian, whatever that word is, in the sense that it's not purely bad, but it's not purely good either. It's to service, in some ways, his vision of how things should have unfolded, which is, but I think, I actually thought you were going to point out that, is it that he pulls the stopper with his hand, which is a very muggle thing to do, right? Like, in terms of, for someone who's used to doing magic, he's like, just everybody uses a wand.
I think
all
it's more like, it's something simple. Like, I feel like you wouldn't go above and beyond to like,
but that's what people always say, the distinction sometimes with like pure blood people, they obviously will use magic, especially slight, like if you know a non-verbal spell, you'll just be like, you know, whatever the hand gesture for opening a bottle might be. But it's the fact that he has an injured hand, he's still struggling as opposed to open it, but it is a very human or human muggle thing to do because you don't have magic. But I just like that. It's not because you point. I didn't even point it out until you pointed it out. So it's fine. It's a good little pickup there. But yeah, anything else about the memory?
Yeah, nothing much about the memory. I did say, I haven't read the not to know, like, I don't know. We've already spoken about this in regards to Merop and all that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, in terms of the memory and everything, Harry's parcel tongue skills. Okay, so moving on to the next chapter, which is Hermione's Helping Hand, where the Quidditch trials happen and some people get confounded or whatever the name of the trick of the spell is. I think I noted this because we were talking a lot about Ron And I picked up that, like, he's obviously complaining about all the studying that they have to do in 6 years and stuff. And it's typical of Ron. He's not very studious. Even Harry's not studious. But I think Ron is even less studious than Ron is. I mean, than Harry is studious. But like, that's why I always keep saying, for me, I like that Ron was included as a character, because he's very much someone who's like a typical student, you know. School is just what you have to do to get through to the next step of your life. But you're not someone who's like book loving, academically, you know, brilliant or whatever they say. So, yeah, I kind of just like, it's a good representation if we're talking about representation, because... Yep, it's very easy to procrastinate and not want to do assignments most of the time.
That is me to a T.
I recognize Ron in me sometimes. but yeah, that's this when Hagrid is also all up in his feels about care of magical creatures. That concludes part 2 of this episode of The Story Never Ends. Check out part 3 for more.